call together, call to order the State Government Finance Division, and we will start by looking at the proposed budget for the AG's office. Rebecca Sparks will be testifying today in place of AG Lori Swanson.
My name is Rebecca Sparks. I'm the Director of Administrative Services for the Attorney General's Office. And I'm going to give you a brief overview of our office and what our budget consists of. And then if you have questions, I'd be happy to try to answer them. The Attorney General is the state attorney. So consequently, we represent over 100 state agencies, commissions, and boards. Our representation includes defending against lawsuits that are brought against state agencies. We also bring claims on behalf of state agencies. The Attorney General's Office also assists rural counties. We try criminal cases. Typically, this would be murder cases. The most recent one that you may be familiar with was the Zavala murder trial. We handle all criminal appeals that come to us from the counties, and we do the civil commitment. And I'm going to give you a comparison. In 2000, we had 4 such cases. In 2008, we had 55 cases. We handle the implied consent for the state. In 1998, we had 3,000 cases, and in 2008, we had 5,800 cases. In addition to that, we enforce the state's civil laws. Those include laws involving charities, antitrust. In the utilities area, we represent small businesses and consumers at the PUC when there are rate increases requested by utilities. In consumer protection, we try to protect consumers in this state against all kinds of fraud. Where we're seeing growth in this area is fraud against seniors or vulnerable adults, and also mortgage fraud. We believe our mission is an important one. We defend claims against the state, we represent state agencies, and we safeguard the economic security of our citizens as well as their public safety. We believe that we deliver bang for the buck. In 2008 and 2007, we recovered on behalf of state entities in excess of $125 million, and in that same period, we saved the state in excess of $200 million in defending against claims filed against various state agencies. Our budget is made up of 66% from the general fund, 25% from partner agreements, 6% from other funds, and 4% federal, and that 4% is our Medicaid fraud unit. The ATO budget is 85% salary, 10% leases, and 5% other, which includes Westlaw research, office supplies, and other needs of a law office. We are doing more with less. We have 40% fewer attorneys than 10 years ago. However, the cases we are handling have become more and more complex. Oftentimes, when we go up against a private law firm, we have one attorney and the opposition has 4 or 5 attorneys on the case. In hard economic times, there's actually more action brought against the state rather than less. And with that, that's the end of my presentation. If you have questions, I'll try to answer them.
Ms. Barth, I'm wondering, I know that the governor is recommending a 5% reduction. Is your office recommending anything other than that, or are you in line with the governor?
We have not recommended being outside of the guidelines simply because obviously the guideline is going to have a considerable impact on our office. However, the Attorney General does realize the very difficult circumstances that the legislature finds itself in.
Any members have questions? Representative Simon.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Ms. Barth. Nice to see you. I have a question just about sort of office priorities, obviously, and I've asked this of all the constitutional offices, so it's the same question for the Attorney General's office. If you had any of the proposed cut restored, where do you think the first dollar would go?
Madam Chair, Representative Simon. I think that is difficult to determine because what happens in state government and what happens in our office is always in flux. And so at this point, I would not speak for the Attorney General and state what I think her top priority would be if we had a restoration of funds. But I can ask her that question and she could get that to you.
Okay, City members, we do have a quorum. And Representative Sanders, have you reviewed the minutes?
Yes, Madam Chair, I have and I move those minutes.
Okay, all those in favor of the minutes?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, the minutes are approved. Are there other questions for Ms. Bart? No? I do have a few follow-up questions. It's actually in relation to Representative Simon's bill, probably because I just came from Health and Human Service Finance where we heard the False Claims Act bill, and I'm just wondering, I'm kind of confused because I did read the article from former Secretary of State Mike Hatch, and he indicated that he thought it would cost the state money, and I'm wondering if the AG's office has a position on that bill, or I'm getting kind of conflicting information, so I'm wondering if you could clarify if the AG's office has a position on the bill.
Madam Chair, I believe the office did do a fiscal note, plus the person we considered the expert in our office, who Deborah Peterson, did testify about the bill. And I am not close to that particular bill, so I couldn't offer you other comments. But I'm certain that she would be willing to comment further, you know, in addition to the testimony that she already provided.
That's all right. Is she here?
No.
Yeah, okay. We'll hold off on that. Any other questions from members? I guess that's all then.
Thank you.
Should we go on to the Campaign Finance Board? Is Mr. Goldsmith here? Thank you, Mr. Goldsmith. Please proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Gary Goldsmith, and I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board. Since each of you has had at least some contact with the board in terms of filing a fiscal campaign committee with the board and filing periodic reports with the board, and hopefully a little beyond that, I won't go into a great deal of explanation about what the board does. Let me just say that the board considers itself to be a resource for the legislature and also for all candidates, lobbyists, PACs, party units, and so on, that are required to register with or report to the board in any way. It's also a great public resource because the legislature in 1974, when it enacted Chapter 10A through the present, has shown a great concern for public access to data that is related to the politics of Minnesota, I believe with the view that public access builds public confidence. And so the board's purpose is really to provide the disclosure that's required by the statute in a way that's meaningful to the public, at the same time to provide service to those required to register with and report to it so that we can obtain voluntary compliance. I was assistant director of the board for 5 years some time ago, have been director of the board now for a year, and it's been our experience throughout many, many years that compliance is always going to be forthcoming and voluntary when people know what they're supposed to do. I want to say a little bit about where we've been, where we are, and some specific things about our budget. Back when the state had a complement system, the board was approved for a complement of 9 in the year 2000. That's when we did a major upgrade to a software product that we still offer for filing campaign finance reports. And that product has built into it all of the compliance rules so that people who use it know if there's a problem with their report. In order to support both the customer service and the software itself, we were approved for an additional 9th person, and we've had that 9th staff position since that time. However, over the recent years, the budget has eroded as salaries and wages go up, and if we were to support 9 people now, it would take a budget in excess of $800,000, which we're not proposing, and the governor is not proposing. Right now, I think the optimum staff size, if we were to run with just paid staff, would be 8.5, and the board actually recommended funding for between 8 and 8.5. The budget I put forth for a recommendation to the legislature would support 8 full-time staff, which is the minimum I think we can use to do our job and do it well enough to continue to gain the public confidence and the confidence of those people that register and report with us. To supplement this 8-member staff would be some data entry services during the next 2 years. After that time, I would hope that we could eliminate that component of the budget in favor of better penetration of our electronic filing system, and thus we would be able to support 8 staff for the next 4 years without asking for additional funds. The reason we can do that is the use of technology. We converted a receptionist front desk person. We eliminated that position and we're able then to reinstate our second IT position. So we have 2 IT positions. And right now, all of our staff, right now we're operating with 8 staff because we don't dare fill the additional position because there will be no funding for it in the next biennium. We're operating with 8 staff and everybody is busy all the time. Things are taking longer to get done. There's been some, but I think minor and probably not noticeable erosion in our customer service, and we're rapidly trying to improve our technology to fill the gap that's been left by having only 8 staff. I have provided a handout. It has yellow and orange columns on it. I've provided the orange column to show you our base budget that we're working from for 2009, and then in the yellow, the 2010-11 budget. As for most agencies, the governor proposed a 5% decrease in our budget, which would mean $698,000. The budget in the yellow column actually includes 8 staff and shows a shortfall of about $50,000 per year. So if you would like to see what the governor's proposal would do to the board, if it is not supplemented, simply look at line 1 and draw a line through the yellow columns in line 1. In other words, eliminate 1 full-time staff person. Now, doing that would leave us with actually a slight cushion, maybe $5,000 per year, and that's on the basis that the governor's predictions are correct. When we were instructed on doing our budget, we were told to include 2.27% increase in wages and benefits in the first year, FY10, and 4.41 total in FY11. So we've done that. We do hope that the governor's negotiating team will be able to keep wages and salaries down to those levels. The board made a formal recommendation when requested by the negotiating group that there be no increases in staff salaries and hopefully benefits, including management. We also said we hope that it doesn't only apply to management, but if it does, we accept that as well. Certainly there are a couple of things, if you look at the line items in our budget, that one might tinker with a little bit and free up $3,000 or $4,000 here and there. Although having analyzed the budget in great detail and looked at it, I and my other executive staff came to the conclusion that these items were very important to the board for staff morale and for increased operation of the board with a decreased level of staff. We do have a proposal that this committee will look at some time in the future, separately from this hearing today, for a means of supplementing our budget by $50,000 per year, and that would be by diverting from an existing appropriation to the general account of the state elections campaign fund the amount of $50,000 each year. To say that in plain English, that means we would take part of an appropriation that is already in statute every year and divert it to the board's operating budget. That already happens for the Office of Administrative Hearings. $65,000 per year goes to them to handle claims that arise with Chapter 10A candidates. And we would urge this supplement to bring the board up to approximately $750,000 per year. And as I've said, we could maintain our adequate staffing and maintain our budget at that level for 4 years. I can't see much beyond that as far as the future goes. By the way, that move would have an effect of about $200 per House of Representatives candidate next year, in the next election year. When the board made this recommendation, it felt that it was important to look at all of the costs of campaign finance in Minnesota, not just the board's operating budget, and that the operating budget was equally important to the public subsidy money paid to candidates, and if candidates needed to sacrifice a bit on their public subsidy to provide sufficient support for board operations, that that would be an appropriate request to make. And the board is not requesting any additional general fund dollars, so that the request we have would be not have an impact on the general fund. Where we're going in the future, we have a bill that is hopefully we'll get a hearing in the House this year. It has actually passed in the Senate, the board recommendations bill, and that bill is designed to do several things, but primarily to allow the board to operate more efficiently and to better use technology in the future. If that bill doesn't pass, some of the predictions that I make here may not be possible, because that bill assumes that we will eliminate certain administrative things in the form of certain certified letters, but more importantly, it provides for electronic filing in the year 2012 with certain waiver requirements and ways that people who can't file electronically or don't use computers certainly don't have to, but for most people we would have electronic filing by 2012. That eliminates the data entry line items in this budget, which we hope to do in 2 years, and it allows us to eliminate data entry by paid staff in favor of being able to provide better customer service and support. When I took over as executive director 1 year ago, I told the board and others in the legislature that my goal was to convert the board to a new business model. The board was previously, and this is before Gene Olson, the previous executive director, the board was essentially a compliance and enforcement organization. People got letters and they were compliance letters. Under Gene Olson's direction over a period of about 12 years, she changed the board model into one of customer service. So it was teaching, it was one-on-one, it was training, the tone of the letters changed, and so on. And that's been quite successful, both internally, because you have to change the internal perception of what we do, as well as externally. However, the model of customer service is essentially a one-on-one model. We get a call, we deal with it, we help the person. And so you're repeating over and over again the same thing. It's very staff intensive. My idea is, which the board supports, and it's one of their objectives, is to now move to more of an educational model, which involves technology. It involves putting training on the internet. It involves tutorials. My staff has made good progress in developing online tutorials. We're in the development and experimentation stage now. But to move to an educational model provides the same level of service, probably better service, because we can't go out and train everybody all over the state, provides better service to our constituents, and yet allows us to maintain the same type of staff level. You have the budget in front of you. I will be happy to go through any part of it that members are interested in talking further about, and otherwise I will take questions.
I do have a question, Mr. Goldsmith. I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit more. I haven't had a chance to see this yet. On your board bill, you talked about providing for electronic filing. I'm assuming you're mandating electronic filing, and you also talked about waivers. So I'm wondering if you could maybe talk about who would be required to file and who wouldn't.
Certainly. Thank you, Madam Chair. There are several components, and first of all, let me say that this would become effective with the 2012 election. So if this bill passes this year, I will be able to come back to the committee next year and say, here's where we are, here are the decisions that have been made. But quite a bit of the plan is already in outline stage, let me say, so let me lay that out for you. First of all, the bill does not require use of the board software. The bill requires transmission of a file to the board in an electronic format. More specifically, the bill will say a standards-based open format. And that means that the board has to develop something that describes a file that could be submitted to us. The most commonly used format right now is one called XML, and it's our expectation that that's the format that we will use, or the standard we will use. An XML file is a text file. It's a little bit like an HTML file in that All of the data is described by little tags, so it would say first name, last name, and so on. But it's a file that anybody can look at in a word processor or a text processor and see exactly what's in it. That's different than what we do now. Right now, a filer submits a database to us, so our own software would not meet this open standard requirement. So first of all, we will modify our software so it meets the new standard. We will define and specify the standard. I have talked to two out of the three major vendors that provide campaign finance software to the public, including Trailblazer and Aristotle, and there's a third who I haven't talked to yet. They're excited about the idea that the board would finally describe a format for a file that they could implement, because they would like to offer that to their customers, and they have some in Minnesota. So there will be vendors producing software. The board will continue to produce and provide its software free, as well as free technical support. For those committees who are small and would not want to take on the learning curve of learning to use any software product, we anticipate that before 2012, we will have a website where you can simply go and type in your totals, just like you would either type them or write them on a sheet of paper. We already do that for lobbyist reports. If we didn't do that, there would be a larger group of people who we would not expect to be filing with the board. And so let me talk about the waiver provision. The statute says that the board must grant a waiver to a person who has good cause not to file electronically. In the statutes, the legislature more than 400 times has used the standard good cause as the basis of how you determine if an act should be done or should not be done. And typically, in all but about two of those 400 times, they don't go on to define exactly what good cause is, but the court cases do, and it's pretty commonly understood that good cause simply means you have to have a reason. It can't be totally frivolous. It couldn't be, I don't want to, or I don't like the idea of sending it to the board even though I could. But what are some good reasons? Well, certainly the first one would be I don't have a viable internet connection, I don't have a computer, or my treasurer doesn't use a computer. The purpose of this bill is not to require somebody to learn how to use a computer or to learn a particular piece of software. If the board doesn't have an online filing system that's web-based, another good reason would be it's not worth learning how to do it, it's much easier on paper. That would be good cause. If the board has a simple form that you can go online and do it, and you have internet access and can do that, that would be a little tougher sell to say that that's not good cause. But it's really, if a person has a reason, a valid reason, the case is, say, not frivolous, not imaginary, the board would be required to grant a waiver from the electronic filing requirement. The statute also has built into it, at the request of some of the caucus committees actually, some protections for large committees, namely the two House caucuses, the Senate caucuses, and the state party units, that will protect them if one happens to file electronically and the other doesn't. The provision then states that the board may not release electronic data for the electronic filer until the same data is available for the other filer, which would mean we have had to data enter that data. So that one person using the software, and again this is limited to the caucuses and party units, but one caucus who wanted to file electronically would not be placed at a disadvantage by having their data more accessible or accessible in a different way than somebody who didn't file electronically. We've also built into the bill a couple of provisions that aren't there now that have general applicability and should be passed regardless. One is that all reports filed with the board in any way are not public data until the day at 8 a.m. the day after filings close. That's what we do on our website already. We hold them until 8 a.m. and then we put them all out on the website. But right now, a person could come into our office and ask if such a report has been filed, and we would have to give it to them because they are public data. So this same provision would also protect caucuses and party units in that if one, let me step back from that, Madam Chair. There's an additional protection for caucuses and party units. There was some concern in the last election cycle that one particular caucus did not file on time. And the concern was, well, the caucus that did file on time was at a disadvantage because the non-filer was able to see what was happening, and the caucus that did not file simply didn't disclose, and the cost of not filing is not significant at this time. So the new provision would say that if one of these caucuses doesn't file on time, that data will remain non-public until both file, unless the filer wishes that that data be released. It would be up to the filer. The board would, however, publish the fact that one caucus filed on time and the other was late, so it would be clear to the public why the data wasn't being disclosed to the public. That's sort of a nutshell. If you have more specific questions or other questions, I'll be happy to try to address them.
Thanks, Mr. Goldsmith. So I understand the caucuses, but there are other very large lobbying groups that are essentially very partisan. How would that, does that play into here at all? Or what would be the, I guess, or would they be required to file, too, electronically? Is it a mandate, or how does that work?
Madam Chair.
You said small, so I wasn't sure exactly what the waiver was.
Under the bill's provisions as drafted, it would be electronic filing would be mandatory for all filers unless they received a waiver based on good cause. So it would apply to political committees and funds as well. We did not attempt to pair those up by saying, for example, that political committee A's report wouldn't be released unless some kind of corresponding committee didn't file, because there isn't that same correspondence as there is with the caucuses or the state party units. However, the same provision would apply to everybody that says no reports are released until the day after filings are due.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Goldsmith. Is there any other questions from members? Representative Mason.
Madam Chair, Mr. Goldsmith, just out of curiosity, how many people at this point are still using, are not using the electronic filing?
Mr. Goldsmith.
Let me see if I have my statistics here. I think I have those in the other bill folder, the electronic filing folder. But what I can tell you is that what we've seen is that more recent registrants are much more likely to file. It's still a minority of filers overall, but in the last election, and in fact in the previous election, for the last two election cycles, more than 50% of candidates who actually file for office use the electronic software, use the board software. Now, if you look at it a little bit differently, as we did, we looked at people who registered their committees prior to or in the year 2000, and there weren't a whole lot of them, but only 14% of that group used the software. If you looked at people who registered from 2000 to the present, 35% of that group used the software. And it was a bigger group also, so we had a couple of hundred in that group, whereas we had only about 15 in the other group. So little by little, it's happening anyway. But there is a large group of people out there who would be able to do this and provide not only more accurate data, because we do data enter all contributions and all independent expenditures into our database. It happens anyway. So that data would be more accurate because it would come right from the committee, and it would be quicker and at less cost to the state.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, and Mr. Goldsmith. I appreciate your work that you do, and certainly following Dean Olson's steps, I'm sure, was a challenge. And she did initiate a lot of really good things, and appreciate what you do. But during this very challenging fiscal time, I do have a couple questions on your line item here. And the three of them that I have, if you could just give a little more explanation, are the achievement awards under line 19, under line 40, out-of-state travel, and under 46, staff development. You might just...
Mr. Goldsmith.
Madam Chair, Representative Kiffmeyer, yes, those are certainly three of the ones that I thought would draw attention if anybody looked at the line items, and I did look at those with great concern and gave a lot of thought to those. These are not just simply carryovers because we want to pad our budget. If we were able to give achievement awards under the two contracts that we have members of MAPE and the managerial plan, those would total $3,000, it would be two achievement awards. In our recommendations to the governor's negotiating team, we recommended that there be no salary or wage increases, But we also recommended that the right to give achievement awards be preserved because we think it is a cost-efficient way to show very valuable employees that they are, in fact, very valuable to the board. And these days, there aren't a lot of other benefits. So it was our position, and it is the board's position, that those are a tool that should still be available. We would much rather see overall wage increases be eliminated than the achievement awards. Also, they are optional, of course, so they are an item that could be eliminated. There's not really much padding or any padding in this budget, so if there is to be padding, that's one place where it would come from. Out-of-state travel is another interesting question. And we are following, of course, the bills that say there shall be no out-of-state travel and watching what happens with them. When you look at a budget and you decide, first of all, I called the Assistant Commissioner for Human Resources up in the Department of Administration, and I said, what out-of-state travel could ever be absolutely necessary to an employee's job? And there are some, in fact, that could be. These would not be the ones we're proposing. What the board has done in the past is, in fact, this is a big cut. There are two things that the board has traditionally participated in. The board has been a member of the Council of Government Ethics Regulators, which is the national organization for state and others, includes Canada, organizations that do the same thing that we do. So we've been a member of that organization. In the past, the board typically sent two staff and two board members to that to the organization's annual symposium. And this is an intensive symposium. There's no golf and no nights off. We start with table topics at breakfast or a speaker at breakfast each day. And so we found that to be very beneficial, both in terms of getting contact for the board to help us with things like technology and also keeping up to date on what's going on in our field of expertise. The FY09 amount is quite low because Jeff Sigurdson, the assistant director, and I were able to take the Amtrak to Chicago instead of fly. The FY10 and 11 assumed that we would have to fly to those conferences, but it's still actually considerably lower than in years prior to FY09 because the board used to send two board members and two staff members, and starting in 09 we sent no board members and two staff members. So while it does still have a line item for out-of-state travel, it's a cut of about 50%. There's a second conference that we typically go to. It's a regional group of regulators like us. Last year it was held in Kansas City. This coming year it will be held in Madison. The cost is fairly low, and the assistant director and I have talked about that and felt that we would probably go even if we have to pay it out of our own pockets. But it's been the board's position in the past that if something is worth going to for staff, that hopefully funding could be provided for it. So that's the out-of-state travel. The last one is staff development. And in this case, we're going to be dropping from 9 or 8.5 to 8 staff. And I believe that that means, I don't believe, I know that that means each staff member is going to have to be more competent in the things they do than they are now. When we had an additional staff member, we could have additional expertise. So while this is an item that is certainly discretionary and might be cut, it would provide a budget for staff members who are going to need to assume additional responsibilities to acquire better skills in things like Microsoft Excel, in some cases business writing, in some cases even grammar. So that's what it would be targeted to help us improve the competency of our remaining staff in order to be able to function with a lower number of staff.
Madam Chair, and Mr. Goldsmith, I appreciate the fact that you have made a good effort here, but I do seeing some of those things, I think those are obvious things when they add up all together with the salary increase. This is about $60,000 over the biennium. So I think, you know, there is some opportunity there. And I certainly appreciate the fact that you've really given a good explanation and made a good effort. But I just think it is, we are in serious times and others don't get pay increases at all. And that's been an issue. So I think for us it's important to consider really looking strongly at those things and would encourage you to do so. And I know that you have, but maybe another look might be in place for considering our time. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Are there any other questions for Mr. Goldsmith? Okay, thank you very much. Next we have the CAP board, Ms. Stark and Mr. Mendel. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Nancy Stark. I'm the Executive Secretary at the Capital Area Architectural and Planning Board.
And I'm Paul Mandel, Principal Planner for the CAP Board.
Thank you. Please proceed.
Thank you. The CAP Board, as we're so often known, was established by the 1967 legislature. We are a small, non-cabinet regulatory agency responsible for architectural design and long-range planning for the capital area. The legislature sets the CAP Board's boundaries, and the Board's responsibilities are found in Minnesota Statute 15B. The Board's mission is twofold. First, to preserve and enhance the dignity, beauty, and architectural integrity of the Capitol, and, of course, the area's unique historic character. And secondly, to help plan and guide its future development by maintaining a flexible framework for its physical growth. The CAP Board consists of 12 members, chaired by the Lieutenant Governor, and is composed of 4 gubernatorial, 3 mayoral, and 4 legislative appointees, and 3 architectural planning advisors advise the board. The staff serving the board consists of 4 employees. We have an administrative assistant, a fiscal officer, Paul as our principal planner, and zoning administrator, and myself as the exec staff. The CAP Board has exclusive zoning jurisdiction and design review over both the state government campus and the surrounding commercial and residential neighborhoods. The agency guides its decision-making with a comprehensive plan and also a zoning and design rules document for a 60-block area around the Minnesota Capitol building. These 2 documents are in process of revision through funding that the agency obtained provided by the legislature in 2007.
Madam Chair, because we are a state agency, we follow Administrative Procedures Act, so we go through the state register. We're not like a municipality where we go through a council. First, we go to our board, we follow publication, state register, we outreach the neighborhood. We've had a task force that's been which we formed about 10 months ago, the Department of Administration, City of St. Paul, the various neighborhoods, and residents in those neighborhoods as well. So that we've been, this is the combined document of both the past and the current, and we're getting it ready to send it over to your advisor's office for formatting, and then we have the usual wait period, comment period, et cetera, going through the Office of Administrative Hearings also. And that zoning, it was last done in 2001 with our comp plan, which is also being revisited now at this time.
Funds also appropriated in 2007 to the Office of Enterprise Technology have allowed the CAP Board to update our website and provide training for staff to maintain the site. The public will find the site very friendly now and with board documents easily accessed, and great links to other state capitals that are in process of doing major restoration work. So I encourage you to take a look at our website. The board has a responsibility to provide the legislature with capital budget requests for the Capitol building and is charged by statute for routing and design of the light rail transit project through the Capitol area.
And for those of you who have followed or have just been reading in the newspaper, I've been here for 21 years, and through that generation we've had 4 iterations of LRT planning. We've been involved in it all the time. Originally, back when it was on I-94 or other routes, they were looking at connecting the two downtowns through the current time. So we've been, originally, with a lot of the work was with the county, with the Ramsey County Regional Rail Authority. Now it's with Met Council and its department administration and others.
The CAP Board's operating budget is $373,000 per fiscal year. Our current base budget breaks down as follows. Approximately 83% of it is for salary and benefits. Rent is approximately 9%. Land and IT charges at 2%, and the rest at 6% is for our business operations. The governor is recommending a reduction of $19,000 per fiscal year in 2010 and again $19,000 in 2011. This represents 5% of our base, our general base operating budget. This being said, these are steps we may need to take so that the agency's core activities will remain intact. They are: reduce agency operating hours and staff time by use of LSS, and a few years back that was called leave salary savings. These were measures that we're very accustomed to. We previously utilized those in fiscal years 04, 05, and then again in 06 and 07. We also may need to reduce the number of board meetings and advisor meetings to review projects and policy. We obviously would reduce any new equipment, office system maintenance, and repairs. We would also limit updating of the agency tools. And for us, that's things such as district maps, small plans, and engineering documents. And of course, we would be eliminating employee professional training and development. The CAP Board has always been proactive in achieving efficiencies of budget and shared services. The agency is located in a building with a large cabinet agency, that being the Department of Administration, where savings are achieved by a sharing of space, equipment, land, connections, IT support, and purchasing programs. In conclusion, staff and I will work to ensure the quality of the CAP Board services provided to you, to the public, and to other state agencies is not reduced. However, the budget reduction proposed will most certainly slow the delivery of the services that we do provide and the timeliness that we are known for. Thank you, Madam Chair. We welcome any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Stark and Mr. Mendel. Do members have questions for the CAP Board? Well, I guess, Representative Kiffmeyer.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. And I appreciate your presentation here today at the CAP Board. I do find our capital is a tremendous treasure. It's extremely unique. It is probably one of the most beautiful capitals. Its rotunda, its design, its dome are incredible. And I find it disturbing, and I think I understand that during really tight budget times, it's understandable that you maybe put some of that off. But I think we need to find a way somehow to not lose our state treasure in our capital, and that sometime in the future when things are better, and that we would maybe think about and plan for that time and see to it that we do maintain, and I think we have a responsibility as legislators to take care of structures like this. It is our job to see to it that they're cared for and funded and not lost in that regard. I think it would be a tremendous shame. So I certainly understand that during this time some of these things set aside a little bit, but I think I would certainly hope that as a legislature we would put it back on the burner when times turn around, which I'm sure they will, and that you should be there then.
Madam Chair and Representative Kiffmeyer, thank you very much for your comments. We too agree that it is time to restore our Capitol building. I think we have watched a number of pre-designs come forward And with anticipation, we look to the working group that was established a couple of years ago to bring forward a consensus for the restoration. But we do also agree that we need to go forward with planning, with design, so that we can reach a consensus of what that restoration is going to look like, how it will be funded, and how everyone will be educated as to the process. So thank you for your comments.
Thank you, Representative Mason.
Madam Chair, who'd ever like to do that? You mentioned that because of the changes, you're going to be, things may be slower. And in view of the fact that things seem to be pretty dire at this point, how much slower and what does that mean for the condition of the building and the activities that are needed to get it to a better condition?
Ms. Stark?
Madam Chair, Representative, when I speak about our budget, I'm talking about our operations. When we are talking about the capital restoration, currently there is no funding to go forward. So the capital would not be considered one of the projects that we would be looking at currently unless there is a planning fund generated and that would go forward. I can tell you that our operations and our board meetings usually have a very lengthy agenda, and we have a number of projects, as Mr. Mandel mentioned, our zoning and also our comprehensive plan, which we are redoing and updating. And these we are hoping will be completed by the end of this year. But that is not to say that we may have to put off some of the meetings for the board to review some of this material and just stretch them out should a greater than 5% reduction or any other influence the board's activities.
And members, that we do, Linda? Right now, we are working with department administration and historical society. We, 1 or 2 years, no, 2 years, the last bonding bill had 13.4 million for immediate needs of the Capitol building as systems fail or need urgent repair. And there has been the consultant that we had on board for the design work has done an exhaustive study of the dome, which continues to leak and has leaked since day one due to the material, marble. It was the last dome, a casket, whatever, made of marble, especially in this kind of a climate. So we have been doing exhaustive research into that with a consultant. Part of that $13 million will go and is now in the works to do some restoration work, some preventive work, and to I believe almost half of that will be going towards buttoning up the dome, actually revisiting and recreating. There's an internal gutter system in the inside. There's three domes, and in between two of the domes, there was a gutter system that we put in because they knew water would get in. And that system is now at its end of its life, so we are looking at actually revisiting that, creating a new system that would then be able to handle the water, so that it doesn't get into the drum and the inside of the Capitol.
Thank you. Are there any other questions from members? Representative Simon.
Just a quick one. Thank you, Madam Chair. I came a little bit late to the presentation, so I'm sorry if you covered this. But since you're dealing with the whole Capitol area and not just the Capitol, I'm wondering about particularly the Sears store. That's a big chunk of land there. Is that something that is a possible site of future sort of expansion of the Capitol area, or I'm just curious. I'm new to this committee, so maybe this is something you discuss every year. But
Ms. Mandel.
The Sears facility, we've had occasional discussions with Sears management over the years. At one point, there was a proposal for a large state building on that. It was an RFP that had gone out, I want to say, like in the late 80s or early 90s. It was a spec office building. There were two different proposals, one on the Kelly site and one on the Sears site. The City of St. Paul has done, as part of the light rail transit planning, for the Avenue, they have done a station area planning where they have taken and master planned the entire Sears complex, allowing for Sears either to remain in their current facility or build a new facility closer to the street, but to infill the entire area with best use kind of development, higher density that would meet still with our comprehensive plan and our height restrictions, but the office buildings, retail, structured parking, because right now the state leases 700 spaces, roughly 700 spaces from the Sears site. The Sears folks are not interested in vacating the premise. Supposedly it's one of their most profitable ventures this side of the Mississippi because, I mean, everything's paid for. But it's been speculated for everything from office buildings for the state to retail to various proposals for stadiums of different kinds. So,
Representative Simon.
Quick follow-up, thank you. And I wasn't even necessarily implying that it ought to be government buildings.
Mm-hmm.
It's just some buildings. Just a personal pet peeve of mine is that now I've been to, I think, 22 state capitals, and almost every single one, even Pierce, South Dakota, has some restaurant or watering hole within walking distance where people can actually really conduct meetings or some business, and I don't necessarily count the Kelly Inn, but we don't have that, and that's sort of a shame. So it would be great. I mean, that seems like a great piece of land on which that kind of development could flourish, along with the Sears store and maybe some government buildings as well.
At one point, Representative Lex did have a proposal for the use of a piece of it on the Avenue. One of the things that both our comprehensive plan, the old strategic plan that's from the Department of Administration, and the city plans all call for is something that would be more than 9-to-5 office buildings, some retail at street level, so it'd be animated. So even if it goes in a lot of it, for office, it would still be a lot more animated, and we're looking at infill that would have retail at least on the first floor, especially given LRT coming in.
Thank you, and we are running short on time out. Let's just take one more question so we can move on. Representative Kalin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just actually a quick caution. I want to make sure that we would integrate any development there to maintain the retail, because those of us that still on our ties from time to time need a place to be able to restock and reload, as the case may be, and I imagine that might be one reason why they're profitable.
Are we looking for an answer from Senator Phelan?
We'll exchange data later.
Okay, I think that's all. We'll move on to the next. Thank you very much.
Appreciate it.
Let's move on. Let's skip past the legislature and go on to the lottery. Is Mr. Harris here? Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Clint Harris. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota State Lottery. With me is Don Feeney, our Research and Planning Director. I want to thank you for the opportunity to discuss our budget today. I'm going to discuss the context of what we do and how our budget is determined, and then I will turn it over to Mr. Feeney, who will discuss the budget in more detail. First, for those of you who might not be familiar with the Minnesota State Lottery as others, our mission is to offer fun, innovative, and secure games that create excitement, reflect Minnesota values, and maximize contributions to the state. We sell two types of games, scratch tickets or instant tickets, and games such as Powerball that you win by matching numbers on a computer-generated ticket to numbers collected in a random drawing. We have no connection to charitable or lawful games, such as pull tabs and raffles, racetracks, card rooms, or casinos. While on the surface this seems like a simple task, let me assure you that it is not. The technology involved with selling hundreds of millions of dollars worth of product through 3,000 retailers is in itself extremely challenging. On top of that, we must take every pain to ensure the security and integrity of our games. The public must have complete confidence that every player stands an equal chance of winning and that every dollar they spend is properly accounted for. Finally, we must operate in a very demanding and competitive marketplace. No retail store has to sell lottery tickets, and no customer has to buy them. The lottery is only one of many products that the customer can choose from, and we are constantly challenged to design and market products that our customers want to buy. Last year, we sold $462 million in lottery tickets. From this, we returned $116 million to state programs, as determined by the Constitution and the legislature. As you probably know, the Constitution requires that 40% of net lottery proceeds be dedicated to the Environmental and the Natural Resources Trust Fund, with the remainder of net proceeds going to the general fund. In addition, an in-lieu of sales tax is divided between the general fund and the Game and Fish Fund and a Natural Resources Fund. That distribution is determined by the legislature. Any prizes that are not claimed within 1 year are awarded to the general fund. Finally, the legislature appropriates lottery funds for the state's compulsive gambling program. The lottery does not receive an appropriation from the legislature. We pay our expenses out of our revenues from ticket sales. However, the legislature does set a limit on what those expenses can be. This limit makes up the lottery section of the biannual appropriation bill. Madam Chair, we try very hard to be responsible stewards of our operating budget, and in fact, of everything that constitutes lottery revenue. We review all expenditures carefully to ensure that they either help generate revenue or guarantee the integrity of our game. While we have not been required to reduce our operating budget, we doubled our efforts to identify areas where we can achieve significant cost savings. Mr. Finney will discuss these efforts in greater detail. That being said, I will not hesitate to invest in new activities, technologies, or products when I believe the result will be additional revenue for the state. Madam Chair, I know you have asked that the focus of this presentation be on the budget. Those of you who would like more detail on our operations can find it in our 2009 overview, which is in your packets. I'd also like to invite any committee member or staff to visit our offices in Roseville to get a better sense of what we do and how we operate. And with that, I'll ask Mr. Feeney to present our 2010-2011 budget.
Thank you. Please proceed, Mr. Feeney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Don Feeney. I am the Research and Planning Director at the Minnesota State Lottery. Madam Chair, we had prepared a slide presentation going through our finances. We decided, given your agenda, that would probably not be as appreciated as we might hope. But copies of that are in your packets if you'd like to look through that, and we can certainly answer questions on any portion of that. As Mr. Harris mentioned, we do not receive an appropriation. Rather, there is a statutory limit placed on how much money we can spend, and that's what constitutes your responsibilities here. That cap includes most of what you would consider to be lottery day-to-day operations. Essentially, the fixed portion of that. What it does not include are what business would call the cost of goods, i.e., the cost of printing tickets, the cost of delivering those tickets to retailers, or the commissions that we pay, or the vendor that operates the equipment to sell games like Powerball, because those vary with sales. And, the less you sell, the less that amount is. The more we sell, the more that amount is. And so that money is outside the budget. To put our finances in context, last year, fiscal 08, was our best year for sales ever. It was a very close second on profits to the state. The reason that there was that little imbalance there is because we make more money on games like Powerball than we do on scratch games, and the Powerball jackpots last year were lousy. We did not sell as much Powerball as we would expect. Therefore, our profit margin went down. Powerball jackpots come back, that margin will go up. We are expecting that this fiscal year we will break the record for sales and we will break the record for profits to the state. As of the end of February, our sales were up 11% from fiscal 08, so we're in good shape. This is unusual. This is not the case in most of the country. For example, Michigan is down 19% from this February to last February. Wisconsin's projecting their sales will be down 4% for the fiscal year. Iowa last year, but even we were up considerably. Iowa was down by 6%. in most states, there are only a handful of states around the country where lottery sales and profits are actually up. We're not entirely sure why we are one of them. I know that there is some substitution going on, that people are buying lottery tickets instead of going out to the casino for an evening or spending an evening playing pull tabs, and you know, a few dollars on a scratch ticket still allows them to do some gambling, but without the expense of the evening out at the casino. But other states are up against that same thing too, and we're seeing increases and they're not. We're not entirely sure why that is. We would like to think that it's because we are doing a wonderful job of producing a product that our customers would like to play, but unfortunately that's not something that I can prove. We are projecting that we will see continued increases in both sales and revenue for both years of the current biennium. Regarding operating expenses, we were not asked to take a cut in our operating expenses for the fiscal year 2009 by the governor, or for that matter beyond. However, recognizing the situation that we were in, we did go to take another look at our budget for fiscal 2009 and for the current biennium, and we made a number of significant budget reductions on our own accord. Fiscal 2009, we cut our operating budget halfway through the year by $2 million, or about 7%. And we were able to do that, I think, in ways that didn't compromise revenue, at least in the short term. In addition, we have attempted to renegotiate the contracts we have with major vendors, which is a considerable expense. We were very successful with our biggest vendor. We renegotiated a contract with them that will save $3.6 million for the coming biennium, and actually $8 million over the life of that contract. We actually, when the governor went to prepare the March budget forecast, I think we were one of the very few sources of income that actually increased from the November forecast. We are requesting a spending cap for fiscal 10 that is identical to our cap for fiscal 9. We're asking for no increase. We are asking for a very small increase for fiscal 11. But just to put this in context, if you take the fiscal 11 number and compare that with the first time we had a cap, which was put in place 8 years ago, we have increased that cap by less than 5% over those 8 years, and our costs by and large have gone up more than that. If you're looking closely, you will notice that our operating budget on the budget sheet you have there is actually less than the spending cap. The reason for that is we budget based on what we expect with what we know now that we will spend. However, we recognize that things come up as they will with the business. We can't foresee what opportunities will be there over 2 years, and we want to have some flexibility so that if the opportunity comes to raise additional revenue to the state, that we have the ability to do that. For example, in fiscal 2008, we suddenly were presented with the opportunity to participate with other states in a game based on the game show Deal or No Deal. This game, and this actually involved us being able to offer as a prize the chance to go to Hollywood play the game with Howie and the banker and on the set and all the rest. And we thought, you know, this is a good way that we could conceivably use some additional money. It turned out to be very profitable for the state. That was we see a lot of interest in those kinds of prizes, that the kinds of prizes that money can't buy, and those can be something from that large to the chance to win $1 million with Howie Mandel, to something as small as the chance to ride on the Zamboni between periods of a Wild game. Because we were able to spend the additional $1 million that we needed to market that game, we were able to return an additional $2 million in revenue to the state. So we need that flexibility within the budget. We decided that we'd make that transparent rather than just try to build it into the budget. If those opportunities are not there, we will not spend the money. However, if the opportunity arises to make an investment which we are confident will result in at least that much money, if not more money, and much more money coming back to the state, we want to be able to take advantage of that. Overall, just to put our budget in context, for the last five fiscal years, we have increased our sales by 31%, we have increased the revenue to the state by 47%, And we've done this while we have cut our operating costs by 25% and our staffing is measured by FTEs by 30%. That's a record that we are extremely proud of. We watch our administrative spending very carefully. We will continue to look for ways to be more efficient as well as ways to generate more revenue. And, Madam Chair, with that, we'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Feeney. Actually, I just had one question. I noticed in the budget book, perhaps you already mentioned this and I just missed it. I noticed you talked about your staff going down, and in the budget book, it looks like you're proposing to go from about 140 to 147. Did you mention why that was?
Madam Chair, I did not. There are two reasons for that. One is that last year, we had a very unusual year in terms of vacancies. We had a lot of vacancies that took us a long time to fill. Our number last year was kind of artificially low for that reason. Beyond that, we're simply using the guidelines that were given to us by the Department of Finance for staffing. We are not adding additional staff.
Thank you. Representative Downey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Does anybody in the state try to calculate the cost to the state of problem gambling, compulsive or addictive gambling? I know you've got a budget line item in here for cost related to that, but do we have any statistics on it?
Representative Downey, that was actually 2 years ago in the Human Services bill. There was a provision asking the Department of Human Services to explore the feasibility of coming up with a number like that. They concluded that you can't do it for a pretty large variety of reasons that I don't think we want to take the time to get into. The appropriation for compulsive gambling in this budget is one of the largest in the country. It's probably the largest for states that don't have something like state-operated casinos or video lottery terminals or something like that. Could more be spent in that area profitably? Yes, it could. No question.
Do you have a follow-up, Representative Downey?
No, thank you. That's right.
Questions from other members? All right. Anything else that you'd like to tell us?
I appreciate the opportunity to present to you our budget, and I think, as Feeney has indicated, we feel very strongly we have a good budget, and we have the flexibility to be able to, as Don, as Mr. Feeney explained, to take advantage of opportunities that come up. We may have one that's fairly large coming up. We don't know if it will happen, but I guess to give you a little information, that the Minnesota Lottery is part of the Powerball organization, sells Powerball. There's another group in on bigger states where they call it Mega Millions. It's the same idea. It's a big jackpot game with big, you know, multi-million dollar prizes. And we've negotiated with them for 2 years, and they've decided that it has to be a good thing for us to sell each other's games. So there is a 60% chance that this fall we will not only be able to sell Powerball tickets to our players, but we will also be able to sell Mega Million tickets to our players. And in the Mega Million states like Georgia and New York and New Jersey will, you know, obviously get the chance to sell Powerball. And we see that as a great opportunity to generate additional revenue. We're still trying to solve our differences between how those two organizations run, and that's what we're doing right now.
Very good.
Madam Chair, we could be consumed in looking at as much as $20 million in revenue to the state should that happen.
Wonderful. I just have one follow-up question before you go. You mentioned that that profits are up, I think you said 11% already this year, which surprises me because the economy is so poor. And I'm wondering, you talked a little bit about why you thought that was happening, but what if that goes down? What would happen if that took a significant hit?
Yep, Madam Chair, our sales peaked at about 11% ahead of the same period last year, and I'm talking July 1st through date. We had launched some very successful games, particularly a $20 scratch game, which has really done a very good job in generating sales. As of this Tuesday, today is our weekly, how much did we sell? We're down to about 6% right now. So I think we're starting to see a little bit of the effect of the economy.
Yep. That triggered another question. Representative Kissmeyer.
Yes, it did very much, and probably has something to do with realizing that in my local area, charitable gambling, I was looking through your book here in regards to the history, the chronology of the whole gambling thing, and just kind of looking back to all of the things going along, and it kind of started with charitable gambling. But what I hear from Legion, churches, all kinds of groups out there, is that while the state may be very successful at getting more and more money, the charitable gambling entities in the local level that fund 4-H, school sports, and other things like that are hurting. And they are not enjoying that increase. And so I think many times, while you have, I think it has also sucked up much of what would otherwise maybe have gone to some of the charitable gambling, which funds a lot of very, very good local projects that otherwise don't have any other kind of funding. And so I appreciate that, but it's probably meant to more of a comment in regards to this and may lead to some future legislation that helps to preserve more of the local charitable gambling, which in some of those situations were very, very local, very, very good for a lot of those small entities that now I think are really hurting from that, and especially during this time. So I appreciate what you're doing, but I think at the other hand, I think some of the local charitable gambling have lost in this whole process. Representative, did you want to reply to that?
Madam Chair, Representative Kissmeyer, just to let you know, we've tried to engage the bars and taverns and the charitable gaming to also sell scratch games there, and we had one retailer decided to give it a try. We actually increased their pull tab sales while there was scratch sales there as well, available to scratch tickets for sale as well. Now, that could be just an anomaly. I don't know. But, you know, there may be an opportunity to do something with the charity industry that would help them as well as us.
Thank you. I think Representative Winkler has some thoughts on that, too.
Madam Chair, Representative Kiffmeyer, since we don't have any Iron Rangers on the committee, I just want to tell you that the common consensus is that it's because of the smoking ban.
Well, Madam Chair and Representative Winkler, that's another bone. Okay, I think we've heard about all we need to hear today. Thank you very much, gentlemen. I think we're going to go on to the Racing Commission because I understand that's going to be a pretty short presentation. So if Ms. Manley can come up.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Manley.
Committee members, my name is Mary Manley. I'm the Deputy Executive Director of the Racing Commission. Today, I'm going to give a very brief overview of our organization operation along with our budget. I submitted two handouts to you. One that just kind of has an overview of the commission's duties, licensing, and some wagering and card club revenue information from both Canterbury Park and Running Mrs. Harness Park. And the other one is an outline of the organization's direct appropriations. And due to the time constraints and the fact that we are not a general fund agency, I will be brief, but do know that you can ask any questions. You know, feel free to ask any questions as I go along. First of all, just to kind of give you an overview of the Racing Commission. The commission itself is a nine-member commission appointed by the governor with Senate confirmation. Each commissioner serves a six-year term. The primary responsibilities of the commission is to issue and renew Class A, B, C, and D license. Class A license is for the ownership license of a pari-mutuel racetrack. Class B permits the operations of racing at a Class A facility. Class C is occupational license, which is required by any individual organization that is providing any service on the grounds of a pari-mutuel racetrack. All employees, horsemen and women, are required to have a Class C license. A Class C license is for county fairs, that desire to race paramutual races as part of the county fair event. Really, in the I think there's been one year that there has been a Class C license issued. They also assign race days. They approve paramutual pools and racing officials. They have oversight of equine drug testing. They also have oversight of the health and welfare of the equine athletes. We administer the Breeders' Fund program, including the distribution of purse supplements to horsemen. Review appeals that the stewards give on disciplinary rulings. They approve and have the oversight of the plan of operations for the cart club. And then they have the ability for rulemaking. As far as the staff is made up of 13.4 positions. 10 of them are full-time year-round. During the live racing, the commission adds, by contract, 6 stewards and 5 veterinarians. We also add temporary employees for the barn techs for the equine drug testing. Our fiscal 2008 appropriated special funds expenditures totaled $913,000. Our fiscal 2009 budgeted expenditures are anticipated to be $899,000 from appropriations from special revenue funds. As far as an overview of what has been in the governor's budget and for our agency overview is the other handout, and what we've kind of done is attached just kind of a brief overview and explanation of each line item on there. Obviously, there are statutory appropriations that we have to collect, and that goes along with the Breeders' Fund tax, which is 1% of the paramutual handle that's wagered at each track, and then it's broke down into breeds and separated out to, and this goes to the horsemen that register their horses to be Minnesota bred horses. There is also a 10% of the card club rate, which is also part of the Breeders' Fund money that goes and is allocated to the horsemen. Basically, our budget and how we are funded is through licensing fees, which, as I said, the Class A license is a yearly fee that the racetracks have to pay to us that are due July 1. Also a Class B license, and then also all the occupational license fees. There's also a reimbursement statute that the racetracks do reimburse the racing commission for the steward fees, the vet fees, all equine drug testing, and card club expenditures. And with that's very brief. I don't know if anybody has any other questions pertaining to. I didn't go into detail on the racetracks, the handles, and that, because that's really not what we're here to talk about. We're here to talk about the budget and how we work our budget.
I was told that you.
Madam Chair, quick question on the Running Aces, the health of the operation. Can you just give us an update? I know that they were in questionable state 6 months ago.
Yes. What I can tell you is that in October there was somewhat of a change of ownership. The lender took over 50% ownership of the racetrack. My office is there. I office out of there. I work very closely with them. And they have done, in my opinion, an excellent job in controlling expenses, doing some of the things that were necessary to do. Unfortunately, we heard of some of the negatives that were things were done, which was the layoff. But I can assure you that there was a substantial number of those layoffs that have been called back. The racetrack seems to be right now, obviously the card room seems to be thriving. They're doing very, very well.
and they are getting ready for the race meet.
Madam Chair, just a quick comment. I was a little bit disappointed that, just from a business perspective, that before they opened, that they, as they had made their investment, they needed us, the legislature, to act, I think, to give them the authority for the card room. If I remember right, there was a piece of legislation that we needed to enact that allowed them to operate under the previous ownership, and I'm just glad to hear that it's an important economic development piece at the very north end of the metro, and I think the Green Acres discussion was actually largely one of the pieces, was sort of how do we keep an agrarian economy going at the edge of the metro area, and this facility is an important way of doing that, and I'm glad to hear that they are turning things around, and that's what I've heard on the ground as well.
Madam Chair, just a comment on the bill that they came in with. It was a bill that they had been trying to get changed, which was they couldn't open the card room until they raised the 50 days. That obviously never didn't come to fruition. It never was passed. They did raise their 50 days and then open their card room. But the bill that did go through and was passed was the All Breed Simulcasting, which has benefited both racetracks. And it gave Canterbury the ability to simulcast the harness signal and all the harness tracks, and gave Running Aces the ability to simulcast the thoroughbreds.
Thank you, Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you much for your presentation and intriguing commission, I'm sure. One question here. I'm seeing a direct appropriations by fund. I would suspect, in looking through all this, and I see these fees along the way, is this generally a connection that basically you have this appropriation by fund, and these are basically the fees collected, and then they are used for expenditures, so that there's a tie-in to both fees and the expenditure that match, that equal each other?
Yes, Representative, that is correct. It is the licensing fees that are paid into us, and then the expenditures go out. We are in the reimbursement of any expenses above that.
Any other questions? Members, thank you very much. Members, we are going to try to push through with one more budget overview from the Office of Administrative Hearings, and we'll wait on the legislature. So is Judge Crouse here? I apologize, it took so long.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I will try to be brief and respectful of your time. I appreciate the opportunity. With me today, I'm Chief Judge Gray Crouse of the Office of Administrative Hearings, and with me today is Susan Fleischman, who is our court administrator. Our budget structure is somewhat different. We have three divisions, and only one of them has any appropriation from the general fund. Our workers' compensation division is funded through the special compensation fund. The administrative law division is funded through charges that we charge the agencies and entities that request us to hold hearings for them. The fees that we charge are approved by the Department of Finance. And then we have the Municipal Boundary Adjustment Group, which does have a very small appropriation from the general fund. We concur with the governor's recommendation, which was that our rates remain the same, and we're very pleased to be able to say that the rates in the administrative law division have remained at the same rate for the last 3 years. The appropriation for the workers' compensation division was kept flat, and there was a 10% reduction in the municipal boundary adjustment group. Within the workers' compensation division, the number of disputes has been up in the last year, although there's been a decline in filings. And I can explain that if you want to know the difference between disputes and filings, but essentially it means there are more contested cases coming to us in the workers' comp division, even though there are fewer injured workers filing claims. More people are contesting the results of the insurance company's decision. Nevertheless, we are still making our commitments and significantly beating our commitments to have all hearings set within 6 months of filing. We're significantly below that. And we continue to feel that, given the complement we have, we'll be able to manage the increased workload and still keep those way below 6 months. We actually also increased in the Workers' Compensation Division the workload really as a result of a request from the Workers' Compensation Bar. They have for years been asking us to take on some mediation in very complex cases where the parties feel a judge is necessary to effectively mediate. And these are cases that the Department of Labor can't do because they don't have judges in place. We've been able to accommodate that, and we have done that with no increase in judges by just working within the people we have and using it actually as a performance enhancement. Some of our judges prefer to do mediations, and so the high performers get to do those, and they consider it, although it is more work on their plate, they consider it a very big positive. We are also working with the Department of Labor in trying to come up with some streamlining and cost-saving proposals for the workers' compensation dispute resolution system. Those proposals have to go through the Workers' Compensation Advisory Council, and we're hopeful that some things will be coming out of that council in the near future that we could present as both cost savings for the special compensation fund as well as streamlining for the injured workers who come through the system. From the Administrative Law Division, our cases in the past year are up about 15%. But again, as I mentioned earlier, our rates have remained flat for the last 3 years. We have taken on, as you may recall, campaign practice complaint cases, and that has been done very successfully. We were able to meet the very short deadlines that were put in that act, and we've also created a web-based database of cases for campaign practice violations and kept the cost of doing those cases very low. Those three things together have, we believe, been the driving force in reducing the number of cases filed. From the time that the county attorneys were doing these hearings to now, when we're doing them, the drop-off has been fairly dramatic in the number of cases filed, and we think it's because of those three factors. Another reason we've been able to be budget conscious is we're trying to expand our revenue base without asking for additional money from the state, and we're doing that by marketing ourselves to municipalities, counties, cities, and townships. And in the last year, we've had a significant uptick in business from those kinds of entities. We are perceived as being very cost effective. Our rates are lower than the rates you would find if you're a city wanting to hire an attorney to be the hearing officer in a particular kind of case. So we are cost effective, we're perceived as being fair, we're very timely, and so we find that cities and townships are seeing us as an attractive way to get their due process hearings done at a relatively low cost in a timely way. The city of West St. Paul is coming online shortly. They have asked us to provide them with a judge, 2 judge days a month to do all of the nuisance hearings that they are converting from misdemeanors to administrative penalties. And that's kind of typical of the kind of thing that we're being asked to do by the various communities. The biggest thing, I think, from a budget standpoint, that I'd like to mention is that we were able to, in the past year, return out of our budget $665,000 through as a result of our move from Minneapolis to St. Paul. That move enabled us to have a facility in the Stafford building that is that our customers find is more convenient, cheaper, and it's a better facility. We've got better technology and better security. We've been able to use through the facilities in that building have many more phone hearings, which reduces the number of, for example, injured workers in the workers' compensation division that have to come physically to have their hearing. We're doing video conferencing for outstate areas at a higher level, and also digital recording, which is also much less expensive than the methods we were using prior to this. I would like to mention also that, as Mr. Goldsmith mentioned when he was talking about the campaign board, we do get an appropriation from the political campaign fund that we use for statewide cases. However, in off years, we use almost none of that, and it all returns back to the fund. And in on years, when there is when there are cases, we still end up using less than the full amount that's been allocated, at least that's in our past history, and return that amount back to the fund as well. I'd like to take just one more minute of your time, if I could, and ask our Court Administrator, Susan Fleischman, to talk about an aspect of the move that we think is something that we're very proud of, but also is something that this committee, and I know we've talked with the chair before, may be instructive for other small agencies, and that is we're sharing services with the Department of Revenue, who also co-locates in the Stafford building. And that has occasioned not only cost savings of a significant amount from our perspective, but increased service levels. So, with your permission, Madam Chair, I'll ask Ms. Fleischman to talk about that.
Yes, please proceed, Ms. Fleischman.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Committee. My name is Susan Fleischman, and I'm the Court Administrator at the Office of Administrative Hearings. And I'd like to talk a little bit about the Office's shared service model that we have been planning for since prior to our move and our relocation to the Stassen building, and continue to find new ways to add to our model and speak to, you know, saving overhead costs and money and improving our services to our clients. We began to take a serious look at ways to share services when vacancies began to increase rapidly in our areas of technology, finance, and supervisory positions. Initially, we were looking to decrease the overall cost of maintaining our office space at the time in downtown Minneapolis, which was prime Class A space. By relocating to St. Paul and co-locating with the Department of Revenue in the Stassen building, we were able to reduce our annual leasing cost by over $400,000. And with that ability, we now have to share services and personnel with the department. We found that we were able to hold positions open and not fill positions as they became vacant in the areas of business financial management, security, technology, and communications. In addition, by co-locating in the Stassen building, we have improved our security to both our employees and the public in our hearing rooms and courtrooms. We're also able to take advantage of sharing space with the Department of Revenue. And also with that, the programming for the vendor services for the security module is a shared cost, and we pay a very low percentage of that when we maintain that security in the building. Using capital security has also allowed us to minimize our outside contracts with security firms. One other cost-saving feature for us was we were able to incorporate our current legal library with the law library at the Department of Revenue. we were able to entertain new ventures that the Department of Revenue has in the areas of, you know, mail, courier services, postage, digital signage, copy center, training opportunities. And I guess one of the things that I'd like to talk a little bit more about was one of the things that you can't necessarily measure prior to a move or even during the move and sometimes after the move, and that's the ability for us to join into a larger agency environment and share services and enhance the quality of our services to both our customers and our employees by joining committees that are in place, adding value to our employees' life in the building by increasing their relationship with other state employees. We were isolated in downtown Minneapolis, and I think that's a value that's hard to put a dollar amount on, but I think it's important for us and the state agencies and the clients that we serve. So, just in summary, a lot of these savings aren't huge dollar amounts, but I think it's important to talk about how a smaller agency like ours, with the ability to join with the larger agencies like the Department of Revenue, we can leverage our services and really save a lot of money and improve just the quality of our time in the building and to other employees. So with that, that's all I have to say about this.
I'd be happy to take any questions. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Representative Schiffner had a question.
Not really, Madam Chair, just a comment. I recall how campaign-related issues were dealt with prior to the Office of Administrative Hearings, having lots of complaints, county attorneys and others as well. This used to be a hot political football that was just a real mess. Since it's been put into the Office of Administrative Hearings, it is a real success story, and really appreciate the professionalism that has brought to otherwise a highly charged area, and so just want to commend you for that. The other thing, and in your presentation, when I first read this and said, kept hearing costs low while increasing levels of service, I'm saying, is this a court? you know, I keep reading these things. You kept your billing rates low for 3 years. You didn't have to, but you did shared service agreements. You did other things. So, in addition, you've been, I think, a great example, and others could follow your example. So, I thought you just deserved a good job. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm sure if I can respond. We view what we do kind of like a business. I come out of the business world, and I think we can provide better service if we attack it that way, and I very much appreciate your comments. That's why we did the move and the other things, because we thought we could return some value, and we appreciate the opportunities we've had.
That's the case. I think we should have more judges from that with that background. Thank you.
Okay. Any other urgent questions? Well, Madam Chair, is there any meetings for the good of the committee? Or any other announcements?
I don't think so. Okay. From my email, thank you very much for taking over today.
Well, thank you. Meeting adjourned.